When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Chapter 1 of The Elusive Pimpernel by Baroness Orczy, read for LibriVox.org by Karen Savage in December 2007. Chapter 1. Paris, 1793. There was not even a reaction. On, ever on in that wild surging torrent, sowing the wind of anarchy, of terrorism, of lust, of blood and hate, and reaping a hurricane of destruction and of horror. On, ever on, France, with Paris and all her children, still rushes blindly, madly on, defies the powerful coalition, Austria, England, Spain, Prussia, all joined together to stem the flow of carnage, defies the universe and defies God. Paris, this September 1793, or shall we call it Vendémiaire, year one of the Republic? Call it what we will, Paris, a city of bloodshed, of humanity in its lowest, most degraded aspect. France herself, a gigantic, self-devouring monster, her fairest cities destroyed, Lyon razed to the ground, Toulon, Marseille, masses of blackened ruins, her bravest sons turned to lustful brutes or to abject cowards, seeking safety at the cost of any humiliation. That is thy reward, O mighty, holy revolution, apotheosis of equality and fraternity, grand rival of decadent Christianity. 5 weeks now since Marat, the bloodthirsty friend of the people, succumbed beneath the sheath-knife of a virgin patriot, a month since his murderess walked proudly, even enthusiastically, to the guillotine. There has been no reaction, only a great sigh, not of content or satisfied lust, but a sigh such as the man-eating tiger might heave after his first taste of long-coveted blood, a sigh for more. A king on the scaffold, a queen degraded and abased, awaiting death which lingers on the threshold of her infamous prison. 800 scions of ancient houses that have made the history of France, brave generals, Custine, Blanchelin, Houchard, Beauharnais, worthy patriots, noble-hearted women, misguided enthusiasts, all by the score and by the hundred up the few wooden steps which lead to the guillotine. An achievement of truth. And still that sigh for more. But for the moment, a few seconds only, Paris looked round her mighty self and thought things over. The man-eating tiger, for the space of a sigh, licked his powerful jaws and pondered. Something new, something wonderful. We have had a new constitution, a new justice, new laws, a new almanac. What next? Why, obviously. How comes it that great intellectual aesthetic Paris never thought of such a wonderful thing before? A new religion. Christianity is old and obsolete. Priests are aristocrats, wealthy oppressors of the people, the church but another form of wanton tyranny. Let us by all means have a new religion. Already something has been done to destroy the old, to destroy, always to destroy. Churches have been ransacked, altars spoliated, tombs desecrated, priests and curates murdered. But that is not enough. There must be a new religion, and to attain that there must be a new God. Man is a born idol-worshipper. Very well, then, let the people have a new religion and a new God. Stay, not a God this time, for God means majesty, power, kingship, everything in fact which the mighty hand of the people of France has struggled and fought to destroy. Not a God, but a goddess. A goddess, an idol, a toy, since even the man-eating tiger must play sometimes. Paris wanted a new religion and a new toy, and grave men, ardent patriots, mad enthusiasts, sat in the assembly of the convention and seriously discussed the means of providing her with both these things which she asked for. Chaumette, I think it was, who first solved the difficulty. Procureur Chaumette, head of the Paris municipality, he who had ordered that the cart which bore the dethroned queen to the squalid prison of the Conciergerie should be led slowly past her own late palace of the Tuileries, and should be stopped there just long enough for her to see and to feel in one grand mental vision all that she had been when she dwelt there, and all that she now was by the will of the people. Chaumette, as you see, was refined, artistic. The torture of the fallen queen's heart meant more to him than a blow of the guillotine on her neck. No wonder, therefore, that it was Procureur Chaumette who first discovered exactly what type of new religion Paris wanted just now. "Let us have a goddess of reason," he said, "typified, if you will, by the most beautiful woman in Paris. Let us have a feast of the goddess of reason. Let there be a pyre of all the gewgaws which for centuries have been flaunted by overbearing priests before the eyes of starving multitudes. Let the people rejoice and dance around that funeral pile, and above it all let the new goddess tower, smiling and triumphant, the goddess of reason, the only deity our new and regenerate France shall acknowledge throughout the centuries which are to come." Loud applause greeted the impassioned speech. "A new goddess, by all means," shouted the grave gentlemen of the National Assembly, "the goddess of reason." They were all eager that the people should have this toy, something to play with and to tease, round which to dance the mad Carmagnole and sing the ever-recurring Ça ira. Something to distract the minds of the populace from the consequences of its own deeds and the helplessness of its legislators. Procureur Chaumette enlarged upon his original idea, like a true artist who sees the broad effect of a picture at a glance and then fills in the minute details, he was already busy elaborating his scheme. The goddess must be beautiful, not too young. Reason can only go hand in hand with the riper age of second youth. She must be decked out in classical draperies, severe yet suggestive. She must be rouged and painted, for she is a mere idol, easily to be appeased with incense, music, and laughter. He was getting deeply interested in his subject, seeking minutiae of detail with which to render his theme more and more attractive. But patience was never the characteristic of the revolutionary government of France. The National Assembly soon tired of Chaumette's dithyrambic utterances. Up aloft on the mountain, Danton was yawning like a gigantic leopard. Soon Henriot was on his feet. He had a far finer scheme than that of the procureur to place before his colleagues. A grand national fête, semi-religious in character, but of the new religion which destroyed and desecrated, and never knelt in worship. Citizen Chaumette's goddess of reason by all means, Henriot conceded that the idea was a good one, but the goddess merely as a figurehead, around her a procession of unfrocked and apostate priests, typifying the destruction of ancient hierarchy, mules carrying loads of sacred vessels, the spoils of 10,000 churches of France, and ballet girls in bacchanalian robes, dancing the Carmagnole around the new deity. Public prosecutor Fouquier Tinville thought all these schemes very tame. Why should the people of France be led to think that the era of a new religion would mean an era of milk and water, of pageants and of fireworks? Let every man, woman, and child know that this was an era of blood and again of blood. "Oh," he exclaimed in passionate accents, "would that all the traitors in France had but one head, that it might be cut off with one blow of the guillotine." He approved of the national fete, but he desired an apotheosis of the guillotine. He undertook to find 10,000 traitors to be beheaded on one grand and glorious day, 10,000 heads to adorn the Place de la Révolution on a great, never-to-be-forgotten evening, after the guillotine had accomplished this record work. But Collot d'Herbois would also have his way. Collot, lately hailed from the south, with a reputation for ferocity unparalleled throughout the whole of this horrible decade, he would not be outdone by Danville's bloodthirsty schemes. He was the inventor of the noyade, which had been so successful at Lyons and Marseille. "Why not give the inhabitants of Paris one of these exhilarating spectacles?" he asked, with a coarse, brutal laugh. Then he explained his invention, of which he was inordinately proud. Some 200 or 300 traitors, men, women, and children, tied securely together with ropes in great human bundles, and thrown upon a barge in the middle of the river. The barge with a hole in her bottom. Not too large, only sufficient to cause her to sink slowly, very slowly, in sight of the crowd of delighted spectators. The cries of the women and children, and even of the men, as they felt the waters rising and gradually enveloping them, as they felt themselves powerless even for a fruitless struggle, had proved most exhilarating, so Citizen Collot declared, to the hearts of the true patriots of Lyon. Thus the discussion continued. This was the era when every man had but one desire, that of outdoing others in ferocity and brutality, and but one care, that of saving his own head by threatening that of his neighbour. The great duel between the titanic leaders of these turbulent parties, the conflict between hot-headed Danton on the one side and cold-blooded Robespierre on the other, had only just begun. The great, all-devouring monsters had dug their claws into one another, but the issue of the combat was still at stake. Neither of these two giants had taken part in these deliberations anent the new religion and the new goddess. Danton gave signs now and then of the greatest impatience, and muttered something about a new form of tyranny, a new kind of oppression. On the left, Robespierre, in immaculate sea-green coat and carefully gauffered linen, was quietly polishing the nails of his right hand against the palm of his left. But nothing escaped him of what was going on. His ferocious egoism, his unbounded ambition, was even now calculating what advantages to himself might accrue from this idea of the new religion and of the national fête, what personal aggrandizement he could derive therefrom. The matter outwardly seemed trivial enough, but already his keen and calculating mind had seen various side issues which might tend to place him, Robespierre, on a yet higher and more unassailable pinnacle. Surrounded by those who hated him, those who envied and those who feared him, he ruled over them all by the strength of his own cold-blooded savagery, by the resistless power of his merciless cruelty. He cared about nobody but himself, about nothing but his own exaltation. Every action of his career, since he gave up his small practice in a quiet provincial town in order to throw himself into the wild vortex of revolutionary politics, every word he ever uttered had but one aim: himself. He saw his colleagues and comrades of the old Jacobin clubs ruthlessly destroyed around him. Friends he had none, and all left him indifferent. And now he had hundreds of enemies in every assembly and club in Paris, and these too, one by one, were being swept up in that wild whirlpool which they themselves had created. Impassive, serene, always ready with a calm answer when passion raged most hotly around him, Robespierre, the most ambitious, most self-seeking demagogue of his time, had acquired the reputation of being incorruptible and selfless, an enthusiastic servant of the Republic. The sea-green incorruptible. And thus, whilst the others talked and argued, waxed hot over schemes for processions and pageantry, or loudly denounced the whole matter as the work of a traitor, he, of the sea-green coat, sat quietly polishing his nails. But he had already weighed all these discussions in the balance of his mind, placed them in the crucible of his ambition, and turned them into something that would benefit him and strengthen his position. Aye, the feast should be brilliant enough, gay or horrible, mad or fearful, but through it all the people of France must be made to feel that there was a guiding hand which ruled the destinies of all, a head which framed the new laws, which consolidated the new religion and established its new goddess, the goddess of reason, Robespierre, her prophet. End of chapter 1. Chapter 2 of The Elusive Pimpernel by Baroness Orsi. Read for LibriVox.org by Karen Savage in December 2007. Chapter 2. A Retrospect. The room was close and dark, filled with the smoke from a defective chimney. A tiny boudoir, once the dainty sanctum of Imperious Marie Antoinette, a faint and ghostly odour, like unto the perfume of spectres, seemed still to cling to the stained walls and to the torn Gobelin tapestries. Everywhere lay the impress of a heavy and destroying hand, that of the great and glorious revolution. In the mud-soiled corners of the room a few chairs, with brocaded cushions rudely torn, leant broken and desolate against the walls. A small footstool, once gilt-legged and satin-covered, had been overturned and roughly kicked to one side, and there it lay on its back, like some little animal that had been hurt, stretching its broken limbs upwards, pathetic to behold. From the delicately wrought boule table the silver inlay had been harshly stripped out of its bed of shell. Across the lunette, painted by Boucher and representing a chaste Diana surrounded by a bevy of nymphs, an uncouth hand had scribbled in charcoal the device of the revolution, Liberté, Égalité, Fraternité, ou la mort, whilst, as if to give a crowning point to the work of destruction, and to emphasize its motto, someone had decorated the portrait of Marie Antoinette with a scarlet cap, and had drawn a red and ominous line across her neck. And at the table two men were sitting in close and eager conclave. Between them a solitary tallow candle, unsnuffed and weirdly flickering, threw fantastic shadows upon the walls, and illumined with fitful and uncertain light the faces of the two men. How different were these in character! One high-cheekboned, with coarse, sensuous lips, and hair elaborately and carefully powdered, the other pale and thin-lipped, with the keen eyes of a ferret, and a high intellectual forehead, from which the sleek brown hair was smoothly brushed away. The first of these men was Robespierre, the ruthless and incorruptible demagogue. The other was Citizen Chauvelin, ex-ambassador of the revolutionary government at the English court. The hour was late, and the noises from the great, seething city preparing for sleep came to this remote little apartment in the now deserted palace of the Tuileries merely as a faint and distant echo. It was 2 days after the Fructidor riots. Paul Déroulède and the woman Juliette Marny, both condemned to death, had been literally spirited away out of the cart which was conveying them from the Hall of Justice to the Luxembourg prison, and news had just been received by the Committee of Public Safety that at Lyon the Abbé du Mesnil and the ci-devant Chevalier de Grammont, and the latter's wife and family, had effected a miraculous and wholly incomprehensible escape from the northern prison. But this was not all. When Arras fell into the hands of the revolutionary army, and a regular cordon was formed round the town, so that not a single royalist traitor might escape, some 80 women and children, 12 priests, the old aristocrats Chermeuil, Delville and Galipot, and many others, managed to pass the barriers and were never recaptured. Raids were made on the suspected houses, in Paris chiefly where the escaped prisoners might have found refuge, or better still, where their helpers and rescuers might still be lurking. Fouquier Tinville, public prosecutor, led and conducted these raids, assisted by that bloodthirsty vampire, Merlin. They heard of a house in the Rue de l'Ancienne Comédie, where an Englishman was said to have lodged for 2 days. They demanded admittance, and were taken to the rooms where the Englishman had stayed. These were bare and squalid, like hundreds of other rooms in the poorer quarters of Paris. The landlady, toothless and grimy, had not yet tidied up the one where the Englishman had slept. In fact, she did not know he had left for good. He had paid for his room a week in advance, and came and went as he liked, she explained to Citizen Tinville. She never bothered about him, as he never took a meal in the house, and he was only there 2 days. She did not know her lodger was English until the day he left. She thought he was a Frenchman from the south, as he certainly had a peculiar accent when he spoke. "It was the day of the riots," she continued. "He would go out, and I told him I did not think that the streets would be safe for a foreigner like him. For he always wore such very fine clothes, and I made sure that the starving men and women of Paris would strip them off his back when their tempers were roused. But he only laughed. He gave me a bit of paper and told me that if he did not return, I might conclude that he had been killed, and if the Committee of Public Safety asked me questions about him, I was just to show the bit of paper, and there would be no further trouble." She had talked volubly, more than a little terrified at Merlin's scowls, and the attitude of Citizen Tinville, who was known to be very severe if anyone committed any blunders. But the citizeness, her name was Brogard, and her husband's brother kept an inn in the neighbourhood of Calais. The citizeness Brogard had a clear conscience. She held a licence from the Committee of Public Safety for letting apartments, and she had always given due notice to the committee of the arrival and departure of her lodgers. The only thing was that if any lodger paid her more than ordinarily well for the accommodation, and he so desired it, she would send in the notice conveniently late, and conveniently vaguely worded as to the description, status, and nationality of her more liberal patrons. This had occurred in the case of her recent English visitor, but she did not explain it quite like that to Citizen Fouquier Tinville or to Citizen Merlin. However, she was rather frightened, and produced the scrap of paper which the Englishman had left with her, together with the assurance that when she showed it there would be no further trouble. Tinville took it roughly out of her hand, but would not glance at it. He crushed it into a ball, and then Merlin snatched it from him with a coarse laugh, smoothed out the creases on his knee, and studied it for a moment. There were 2 lines of what looked like poetry, written in a language which Merlin did not understand, English, no doubt. But what was perfectly clear, and easily comprehended by anyone, was the little drawing in the corner, done in red ink and representing a small, star-shaped flower. Then Tinville and Merlin both cursed loudly and volubly, and bidding their men follow them, turned away from the house in the Rue de l'Ancienne Comédie, and left its toothless landlady on her own doorstep, still volubly protesting her patriotism and her desire to serve the government of the Republic. Tinville and Merlin, however, took the scrap of paper to Citizen Robespierre, who smiled grimly as he, in his turn, crushed the offensive little document in the palm of his well-washed hands. Robespierre did not swear. He never wasted either words or oaths, but he slipped the bit of paper inside the double lid of his silver snuff-box, and then he sent a special messenger to Citizen Chauvelin in the Rue Corneille, bidding him come that same evening after 10 o'clock to room number 16 in the ci-devant palace of the Tuileries. It was now 10:30, and Chauvelin and Robespierre sat opposite one another in the ex-boudoir of Queen Marie Antoinette, and between them on the table, just below the tallow candle, was a much creased, exceedingly grimy bit of paper. It had passed through several unclean hands before Citizen Robespierre's immaculately white fingers had smoothed it out and placed it before the eyes of ex-ambassador Chauvelin. The latter, however, was not looking at the paper. He was not even looking at the pale, cruel face before him. He had closed his eyes and for a moment had lost sight of the small, dark room, of Robespierre's ruthless gaze, of the mud-stained walls and greasy floor. He was seeing, as in a bright and sudden vision, the brilliantly lighted salons of the Foreign Office in London, with beautiful Marguerite Blakeney gliding queen-like on the arm of the Prince of Wales. He heard the flutter of many fans, the frou-frou of silk dresses, and above all the din and sound of dance music, he heard an inane laugh and an affected voice repeating the doggerel rhyme that was even now written on that dirty piece of paper which Robespierre had placed before him. "We seek him here, and we seek him there. Those Frenchies seek him everywhere. Is he in heaven? Is he in hell? That demmed elusive Pimpernel." It was a mere flash, one of memory's swiftly effaced pictures, when she shows us for the fraction of a second indelible pictures from out of our past. Chauvelin, in that same second, while his own eyes were closed and Robespierre's fixed upon him, also saw the lonely cliffs of Calais, heard the same voice singing, "God save the King," the volley of musketry, the despairing cries of Marguerite Blakeney, and once again he felt the keen and bitter pang of complete humiliation and defeat. End of chapter 2. Chapter 3 of The Elusive Pimpernel by Baroness Orzy, read for LibriVox.org by Karen Savage in December 2007. Chapter 3. Ex-Ambassador Chauvelin. Robespierre had quietly waited the while. He was in no hurry. Being a night bird of very pronounced tastes, he was quite ready to sit here until the small hours of the morning, watching Citizen Chauvelin mentally writhing in the throes of recollections of the past few months. There was nothing that delighted the sea-green incorruptible quite so much as the aspect of a man struggling with a hopeless situation and feeling a net of intrigue drawing gradually tighter and tighter around him. Even now, when he saw Chauvelin's smooth forehead wrinkled into an anxious frown and his thin hand nervously clutched upon the table, Robespierre heaved a pleasurable sigh, leaned back in his chair, and said with an amiable smile, "You do agree with me, then, citizen, that the situation has become intolerable?" Then, as Chauvelin did not reply, he continued, speaking more sharply, "And how terribly galling it all is, when we could have had that man under the guillotine by now, if you had not blundered so terribly last year." His voice had become hard and trenchant, like that knife to which he was so ready to make constant allusion. But Chauvelin still remained silent. There was really nothing that he could say. "Citizen Chauvelin, how you must hate that man!" exclaimed Robespierre at last. Then only did Chauvelin break the silence which up to now he had appeared to have forced himself to keep. "I do," he said with unmistakable fervour. "Then why do you not make an effort to retrieve the blunders of last year?" queried Robespierre blandly. "The Republic has been unusually patient and long-suffering with you, Citizen Chauvelin. She has taken your many services and well-known patriotism into consideration. But you know," he added significantly, "that she has no use for worthless tools." Then, as Chauvelin seemed to have relapsed into sullen silence, he continued with his original ill-omened blandness, "Ma foi, Citizen Chauvelin, were I standing in your buckled shoes, I would not lose another hour in trying to avenge mine own humiliation." "Have I ever had a chance?" burst out Chauvelin with ill-suppressed vehemence. "What can I do single-handed? Since war has been declared, I cannot go to England unless the government will find some official reason for my doing so. There is much grumbling and wrath over here, and when that damned Scarlet Pimpernel League has been at work, when a score or so of valuable prizes have been snatched from under the very knife of the guillotine, then there is much gnashing of teeth and useless cursings, but nothing serious or definite is done to smother those accursed English flies which come buzzing about our ears." "Nay, you forget, Citizen Chauvelin," retorted Robespierre, "that we of the Committee of Public Safety are far more helpless than you. You know the language of these people, we don't. You know their manners and customs, their ways of thought, the methods they are likely to employ. We know none of these things. You have seen and spoken to men in England who are members of that damned league. You have seen the man who is its leader. We have not." He leant forward on the table and looked more searchingly at the thin, pallid face before him. "If you named that leader to me now, if you described him, we could go to work more easily." "You could name him, and you would, Citizen Chauvelin." "I cannot," retorted Chauvelin doggedly. "Ah, but I think you could. But there, I do not blame your silence. You would wish to reap the reward of your own victory, to be the instrument of your own revenge. Passions! I think it natural. But in the name of your own safety, citizen, do not be too greedy with your secret. If the man is known to you, find him again. Find him, lure him to France. We want him. The people want him. And if the people do not get what they want, they will turn on those who have withheld their prey. I understand, citizen, that your own safety and that of your government is involved in this renewed attempt to capture the Scarlet Pimpernel," retorted Chauvelin dryly. "And your head, Citizen Chauvelin," concluded Robespierre. "Nay, I know that well enough, and you may believe me, and you will, citizen, when I say that I care but little about that. The question is, if I am to lure that man to France, what will you and your government do to help me?" "Everything," replied Robespierre, "provided you have a definite plan and a definite purpose." "I have both. But I must go to England in, at least, a semi-official capacity. I can do nothing if I am to hide in disguise in out-of-the-way corners." "That is easily done. There has been some talk with the British authorities anent the security and welfare of peaceful French subjects settled in England. After a good deal of correspondence, they have suggested our sending a semi-official representative over there to look after the interests of our own people commercially and financially. We can easily send you over in that capacity, if it would suit your purpose." "Admirably. I have only need of a cloak. That one will do as well as another." "Is that all?" "Not quite. I have several plans in my head, and I must know that I am fully trusted. Above all, I must have power. Decisive, absolute, illimitable power." There was nothing of the weakling about this small, sable-clad man, who looked the redoubtable Jacobin leader straight in the face, and brought a firm fist resolutely down upon the table before him. Robespierre paused a while ere he replied. He was eyeing the other man keenly, trying to read if behind that earnest, frowning brow there did not lurk some selfish, ulterior motive along with that demand for absolute power. But Chauvelin did not flinch beneath that gaze, which could make every cheek in France blanch with unnamed terror. And after that slight moment of hesitation, Robespierre said quietly, "You shall have the complete power of a military dictator in every town or borough of France which you may visit. The revolutionary government shall create you, before you start for England, supreme head of all the sub-committees of public safety. This will mean that in the name of the safety of the Republic, every order given by you, of whatsoever nature it might be, must be obeyed implicitly under pain of an arraignment for treason." Chauvelin sighed a quick, sharp sigh of intense satisfaction, which he did not even attempt to disguise before Robespierre. "I shall want agents," he said, "or shall we say, spies? And, of course, money." "You shall have both. We keep a very efficient secret service in England, and they do a great deal of good over there. There is much dissatisfaction in their Midland counties. You remember the Birmingham riots? They were chiefly the work of our own spies. Then you know Candeille, the actress? She had found her way among some of those circles in London who have what they call liberal tendencies. I believe they are called Whigs. Funny name, isn't it? It means perruque, I think. Candeille has given charity performances in aid of our Paris poor, in one or two of these Whig clubs, and incidentally, she has been very useful to us. A woman is always useful in such cases. I shall seek out the citizeness Candeille. And if she renders you useful assistance, I think I can offer her what should prove a tempting prize. Women are so vain," he added, contemplating with rapt attention the enamel-like polish on his fingernails. "There is a vacancy in the Maison Moliere, or, what might prove more attractive still, in connection with the proposed national fête and the new religion for the people, we have not yet chosen a goddess of reason. That should appeal to any feminine mind. The impersonation of a goddess, with processions, pageants, and the rest. Great importance and prominence given to one personality. What say you, citizen? If you really have need of a woman for the furtherance of your plans, you have that at your disposal which may enhance her zeal." "I thank you, citizen," rejoined Chauvelin calmly. I always entertained a hope that some day the revolutionary government would call again on my services. I admit that I failed last year. The Englishman is resourceful. He has wits and he is very rich. He would not have succeeded, I think, but for his money, and corruption and bribery are rife in Paris and on our coasts. He slipped through my fingers at the very moment when I thought that I held him most securely. I do admit all that, but I am prepared to redeem my failure of last year, and there is nothing more to discuss. I am ready to start." He looked round for his cloak and hat, and quietly readjusted the set of his necktie. But Robespierre detained him a while longer. That born mountebank, born torturer of the souls of men, had not gloated sufficiently yet on the agony of mind of this fellow man. Chauvelin had always been trusted and respected. His services in connection with the foreign affairs of the revolutionary government had been invaluable, both before and since the beginning of the European War. At one time he formed part of that merciless decemvirate which, with Robespierre at its head, meant to govern France by laws of bloodshed and of unparalleled ferocity. But the sea-green incorruptible had since tired of him, then had endeavoured to push him on one side, for Chauvelin was keen and clever, and, moreover, he possessed all those qualities of selfless patriotism which were so conspicuously lacking in Robespierre. His failure in bringing that interfering Scarlet Pimpernel to justice and the guillotine had completed Chauvelin's downfall. Though not otherwise molested, he had been left to moulder in obscurity during this past year. He would soon enough have been completely forgotten. Now he was not only to be given one more chance to regain public favour, but he had demanded powers which, in consideration of the aim in view, Robespierre himself could not refuse to grant him. But the incorruptible, ever envious and jealous, would not allow him to exult too soon. With characteristic blandness he seemed to be entering into all Chauvelin's schemes, to be helping in every way he could, for there was something at the back of his mind which he meant to say to the ex-ambassador before the latter took his leave, something which would show him that he was but on trial once again, and which would demonstrate to him with perfect clearness that over him there hovered the all-powerful hand of a master. "You have but to name the sum you want, Citizen Chauvelin," said the incorruptible with an encouraging smile. "The government will not stint you, and you shall not fail for lack of authority or for lack of funds." "It is pleasant to hear that the government has such uncounted wealth," remarked Chauvelin with dry sarcasm. "Oh, the last few weeks have been very profitable," retorted Robespierre. "We have confiscated money and jewels from emigrant royalists to the tune of several million francs. You remember the traitor, Juliette Marny, who escaped to England lately? Well, her mother's jewels, and quite a good deal of gold, were discovered by one of our most able spies to be under the care of a certain Abbé Fouquet, a calotin from Boulogne, devoted to the family, so it seems." "Yes?" queried Chauvelin indifferently. "Our men seized the jewels and gold, that is all. We don't know yet what we mean to do with the priest. The fisherfolk of Boulogne like him, and we can lay our hands on him at any time if we want his old head for the guillotine. But the jewels were worth having. There's a historic necklace worth 500,000 at least." "Could I have it?" asked Chauvelin. Robespierre laughed and shrugged his shoulders. "You said it belonged to the Marny family," continued the ex-ambassador. "Juliette Marny is in England. I might meet her. I cannot tell what may happen, but I feel that the historic necklace might prove useful." "Just as you please," he added with renewed indifference. "It was a thought that flashed through my mind when you spoke, nothing more." "And to show you how thoroughly the government trusts you, Citizen Chauvelin," replied Robespierre with perfect urbanity, "I will myself direct that the Marny necklace be placed unreservedly in your hands, and a sum of 50,000 francs for your expenses in England. You see," he added blandly, "we give you no excuse for a second failure." "I need none," retorted Chauvelin dryly, as he finally rose from his seat with a sigh of satisfaction that this interview was ended at last. But Robespierre too had risen, and pushing his chair aside he took a step or two towards Chauvelin. He was a much taller man than the ex-ambassador. Spare and gaunt, he had a very upright bearing, and in the uncertain light of the candle he seemed to tower strangely and weirdly above the other man. The pale hue of his coat, his light-coloured hair, the whiteness of his linen, all helped to give his appearance at that moment a curious spectral effect. Chauvelin somehow felt an unpleasant shiver running down his spine as Robespierre, perfectly urbane and gentle in his manner, placed a long, bony hand upon his shoulder. "Citizen Chauvelin," said the incorruptible with some degree of dignified solemnity, "meseems that we very quickly understood one another this evening. Your own conscience, no doubt, gave you a premonition of what the purport of my summons to you would be. You say that you always hoped the revolutionary government would give you one great chance to redeem your failure of last year. I, for one, always intended that you should have that chance, for I saw, perhaps, just a little deeper into your heart than my colleagues. I saw not only enthusiasm for the cause of the people of France, not only abhorrence for the enemy of your country, I saw a purely personal and deadly hate of an individual man, the unknown and mysterious Englishman who proved too clever for you last year. And because I believe that hatred will prove sharper and more far-seeing than selfless patriotism, therefore I urged the Committee of Public Safety to allow you to work out your own revenge, and thereby to serve your country more effectually than any other, perhaps more pure-minded patriot would do. You go to England well provided with all that is necessary for the success of your plans, for the accomplishment of your own personal vengeance. The revolutionary government will help you with money, passports, safe conducts. It places its spies and agents at your disposal. It gives you practically unlimited power wherever you may go. It will not inquire into your motives, nor yet your means, so long as these lead to success. But private vengeance or patriotism, whatever may actuate you, we here in France demand you deliver into our hands the man who is known in two countries as the Scarlet Pimpernel. We want him alive if possible, or dead if it must be so, and we want as many of his henchmen as will follow him to the guillotine. Get them to France, and we'll know how to deal with them, and let the whole of Europe be damned." He paused for a while, his hand still resting on Chauvelin's shoulder, his pale green eyes holding those of the other man as if in a trance. But Chauvelin neither stirred nor spoke. His triumph left him quite calm. His fertile brain was already busy with his plans. There was no room for fear in his heart, and it was without the slightest tremor that he waited for the conclusion of Robespierre's oration. "Perhaps, Citizen Chauvelin," said the latter at last, "you have already guessed what there is left for me to say. But lest there should remain in your mind one faint glimmer of doubt or of hope, let me tell you this. The revolutionary government gives you this chance of redeeming your failure, but this one only. If you fail again, your outraged country will know neither pardon nor mercy. Whether you return to France or remain in England, whether you travel north, south, east or west, cross the oceans or traverse the Alps, the hand of an avenging people will be upon you. Your second failure will be punished by death, wherever you may be, either by the guillotine if you are in France, or if you seek refuge elsewhere, than by the hand of an assassin. Look to it, Citizen Chauvelin, for there will be no escape this time, not even if the mightiest tyrant on earth tried to protect you, not even if you succeeded in building up an empire and placing yourself upon a throne." His thin, strident voice echoed weirdly in the small, close boudoir. Chauvelin made no reply. There was nothing that he could say. All that Robespierre had put so emphatically before him, he had fully realized, even whilst he was forming his most daring plans. It was an either-or this time, uttered to him now. He thought again of Marguerite Blakeney and the terrible alternative he had put before her less than a year ago. Well, he was prepared to take the risk. He would not fail again. He was going to England under more favourable conditions this time. He knew who the man was whom he was bidden to lure to France and to death. And he returned Robespierre's threatening gaze boldly and unflinchingly. Then he prepared to go. He took up his hat and cloak, opened the door and peered for a moment into the dark corridor, wherein, in the far distance, the steps of a solitary sentinel could be faintly heard. He put on his hat, turned to look once more into the room where Robespierre stood quietly watching him, and went his way. End of chapter 3. Chapter 4 of The Elusive Pimpernel by Baroness Orzy, read for LibriVox.org by Karen Savage in December 2007. Chapter 4. The Richmond Gala. It was perhaps the most brilliant September ever known in England, where the last days of dying summer are nearly always golden and beautiful. Strange that in this country, where that same season is so peculiarly radiant with a glory all its own, there should be no special expression in the language with which to accurately name it. So we needs must call it fin d'été, the ending of the summer, not the absolute end, nor yet the ultimate departure, but the tender lingering of a friend obliged to leave us anon, yet who fain would steal a day here and there, a week or so in which to stay with us, who would make that last pathetic farewell of his endure a little while longer still, and bring forth in gorgeous array for our final gaze all that he has which is most luxuriant, most desirable, most worthy of regret. And in this year of grace, 1793, departing summer had lavished the treasures of her palette upon woodland and river banks, had tinged the once crude green of larch and elm with a tender hue of gold, had brushed the oaks with tones of warm russet, and put patches of sienna and crimson on the beach. In the gardens the roses were still in bloom, not the delicate blush or lemon ones of June, nor yet the pale banksias and climbers, but the full-blooded red roses of late summer, and deep-coloured apricot ones, with crinkled outside leaves faintly kissed by the frosty dew. In sheltered spots the purple clematis still lingered, whilst the dahlias, brilliant of hue, seemed overbearing in their gorgeous insolence, flaunting their crudely coloured petals against sober backgrounds of mellow leaves or the dull mossy tones of ancient encircling walls. The gala had always been held about the end of September. The weather on the riverside was most dependable then, and there was always sufficient sunshine as an excuse for bringing out Madame's last new muslin gown or her pale-coloured quilted petticoat. Then the ground was dry and hard, good alike for walking and for setting up tents and booths. And of these there was of a truth a most goodly array this year. Mountebanks and jugglers from every corner of the world, so it seemed, for there was a man with a face as black as my lord's tricorn, and another with such flat yellow cheeks as made one think of batter pudding and spring aconite, of eggs and other very yellow things. There was a tent wherein dogs, all sorts of dogs, big, little, black, white or tan, did things which no Christian with respect for his own backbone would have dared to perform, and another where a weird-faced old man made beanstalks and walking-sticks, coins of the realm and lace kerchiefs, vanish into thin air. And as it was nice and hot, one could sit out upon the green and listen to the strains of the band, which discoursed sweet music, and watch the young people tread a measure on the sward. The quality had not yet arrived, for humbler folk had partaken of very early dinner so as to get plenty of fun, and long hours of delight for the sixpenny toll demanded at the gates. There was so much to see and so much to do, games of bowls on the green and a beautiful Aunt Sally, there was a skittle alley and two merry-go-rounds, there were performing monkeys and dancing bears, a woman so fat that three men with arms outstretched could not get round her, and a man so thin that he could put a lady's bracelet round his neck and her garter round his waist. There were some funny little dwarfs with pinched faces and a knowing manner, and a giant come all the way from Russia, so 'twas said. The mechanical toys, too, were a great attraction. You dropped a penny into a little slit in a box, and a doll would begin to dance and play the fiddle. And there was the magic mill, where, for another modest copper, a row of tiny figures, wrinkled and old and dressed in the shabbiest of rags, marched in weary procession up a flight of steps into the mill, only to emerge again the next moment at a further door of this wonderful building, looking young and gay, dressed in gorgeous finery and tripping a dance measure as they descended some steps and were finally lost to view. But what was most wonderful of all, and collected the goodliest crowd of gazers and the largest amount of coins, was a miniature representation of what was going on in France, even at this very moment. And you could not help but be convinced of the truth of it all, so cleverly was it done. There was a background of houses and a very red-looking sky. Too red, some people said, but were immediately quashed by the dictum of the wise, that the sky represented a sunset, as any one who'd looked could see. Then there were a number of little figures, no taller than your hand, but with little wooden faces and arms and legs, just beautifully made little dolls, and these were dressed in kirtles and breeches, all rags mostly, and little coats and wooden shoes. They were massed together in groups with their arms all turned upwards. And in the centre of this little stage, on an elevated platform, there were miniature wooden posts close together, and with a long flat board at right angles at the foot of the posts, and all painted a bright red. At the further end of the boards was a miniature basket, and between the two posts at the top was a miniature knife which ran up and down in a groove, and was drawn by a miniature pulley. Folk who knew said that this was a model of a guillotine. And lo and behold, when you dropped a penny into a slot just below the wooden stage, the crowd of little figures started waving their arms up and down, and another little doll would ascend the elevated platform and lie down on the red board at the foot of the wooden posts. Then a figure dressed in brilliant scarlet put out an arm, presumably to touch the pulley, and the tiny knife would rattle down onto the poor little reclining doll's neck, and its head would roll off into the basket beyond. Then there was a loud whir of wheels, a buzz of internal mechanism, and all the little figures would stop dead with arms outstretched, whilst the beheaded doll rolled off the board and was lost to view, no doubt preparatory to going through the same gruesome pantomime again. It was very thrilling and very terrible. A certain air of hushed awe reigned in the booth where this mechanical wonder was displayed. The booth itself stood in a secluded portion of the grounds, far from the toll gates and the bandstand and the noise of the merry-go-round, and there were great texts written in red letters on a black ground pinned all along the walls. "Please spare a copper for the starving poor of Paris." A lady dressed in grey quilted petticoat and pretty grey and black striped panniers could be seen walking in the booth from time to time, then disappearing through a partition beyond. She would emerge again presently carrying an embroidered reticule, and would wander round among the crowd, holding out the bag by its chain, and repeating in tones of somewhat monotonous appeal, "For the starving poor of Paris, if you please." She had fine dark eyes, rather narrow and tending upwards at the outer corners, which gave her face a not altogether pleasant expression. Still, they were fine eyes, and when she went round soliciting alms, most of the men put a hand into their breeches pocket and dropped a coin into her embroidered reticule. She said the word poor in a rather funny way, rolling the R at the end, and she also said please as if it was spelt with a long line of E's, and so it was concluded that she was French and was begging for her poorer sisters. At stated intervals during the day, the mechanical toy was rolled into a corner, and the lady in grey stood up on a platform and sang queer little songs, the words of which nobody could understand. "Il était une bergère, héron et petit patapon." But it all left an impression of sadness and of suppressed awe upon the minds and susceptibilities of the worthy Richmond yokels come with their wives or sweethearts to enjoy the fun of the fair, and gladly did every one emerge out of that melancholy booth into the sunshine, the brightness, and the noise. "Lud, but she do give me the creeps," said Mistress Polly, the pretty barmaid from the Bell Inn down by the river, "and I must say I don't see why we English folk should send our hard-earned pennies to those murdering ruffians over the water. Bein' starving, so to speak, don't make a murderer a better man if he goes on murdering," she added with undisputable, if ungrammatical, logic. "Come, let's look at something more cheerful now." And without waiting for anyone else's assent, she turned towards the more lively portion of the grounds, closely followed by a ruddy-faced, somewhat sheepish-looking youth, who very obviously was her attendant swain. It was getting on for 3 o'clock now, and the quality were beginning to arrive. Lord Antony Dewhurst was already there, chucking every pretty girl under the chin, to the annoyance of her beau. Ladies were arriving all the time, and the humbler feminine hearts were constantly set aflutter at sight of rich brocaded gowns and the new charlottes, all crinkled velvet and soft marabou, which were so becoming to the pretty faces beneath. There was incessant and loud talking and chattering, with here and there the shriller tones of a French voice being distinctly noticeable in the din. There were a good many French ladies and gentlemen present, easily recognizable even in the distance, for their clothes were of more sober hue and of lesser richness than those of their English compeers. But they were great lords and ladies nevertheless, dukes and duchesses and countesses, come to England for fear of being murdered by those devils in their own country. Richmond was full of them just now, as they were made right welcome both at the palace and at the magnificent home of Sir Percy and Lady Blakeney. "Ah! Here comes Sir Andrew Ffoulkes with his lady, so pretty and dainty does she look, like a little china doll in her new-fashioned short-waisted gown, her brown hair in soft waves above her smooth forehead, her great hazel eyes fixed in unaffected admiration on the gallant husband by her side. No wonder she dotes on him," sighed pretty Mistress Polly, after she had bobbed her curtsy to my lady. "The brave deeds he did for love of her! Rescued her from those murderers over in France, and brought her to England safe and sound, having fought no end of them single-handed, or so I've heard it said. Have you not, Master Thomas Jezzard?" And she looked defiantly at her meek-looking cavalier. "Bah!" replied Master Thomas, with quite unusual vehemence in response to the disparaging look in her brown eyes. "'Tis not he who did it all, as well you know, Mistress Polly. Sir Andrew Ffoulkes is a gallant gentleman, you may take your Bible oath on that. But he that fights the murdering frog-eater single-handed is he whom they call the Scarlet Pimpernel, the bravest gentleman in all the world." Then, as at mention of the national hero, he thought that he detected in Mistress Polly's eyes an enthusiasm which he could not very well ascribe to his own individuality, he added with some pique, "But they do say that this same Scarlet Pimpernel is mightily ill-favoured, and that's why no one ever sees him. They say he is fit to scare the crows away, and that no Frenchie can look twice at his face, for it's so ugly, and so they let him get out of the country rather than look at him again." "Then they do say a mighty lot of nonsense," retorted Mistress Polly, with a shrug of her pretty shoulders. "And if that be so, then why don't you go over to France and join hands with the Scarlet Pimpernel? I'll warrant no Frenchman'll want to look twice at your face." A chorus of laughter greeted this sally, for the two young people had in the meanwhile been joined by several of their friends, and now formed part of a merry group near the band, some sitting, others standing, but all bent on seeing as much as there was to see in Richmond Gala this day. There was Johnny Cullen, the grocer's apprentice from Twickenham, and Ursula Queckett, the baker's daughter, and several young'uns from the neighbourhood, as well as some older folk. And all of them enjoyed a joke when they heard one, and thought Mistress Polly's retort mightily smart. But then Mistress Polly was possessed of £200 all her own, left to her by her grandmother, and on the strength of this extensive fortune had acquired a reputation for beauty and wit not easily accorded to a wench that had been penniless. But Mistress Polly was also very kind-hearted. She loved to tease Master Jezzard, who was an indefatigable hanger-on at her pretty skirts, and whose easy conquest had rendered her somewhat contemptuous, but at the look of perplexed annoyance and bewildered distress on the lad's face, her better nature soon got the upper hand. She realized that her remark had been unwarrantably spiteful, and wishing to make atonement, she said with a touch of coquetry which quickly spread balm over the honest yokel's injured vanity, "La, Master Jezzard, you do seem to make a body say some queer things. But there, you must own 'tis mighty funny about that Scarlet Pimpernel," she added, appealing to the company in general, just as if Master Jezzard had been disputing the fact. "Why won't he let anyone see who he is? And those who know him won't tell. Now I have it for a fact from my lady's own maid Lucy that the young lady as is stopping at Lady Blakeney's house has actually spoken to the man. She came over from France, come a fortnight tomorrow, she and the gentleman they call Monsieur Deroulede. They both saw the Scarlet Pimpernel and spoke to him. He brought them over from France. Then why won't they say?" "Say what?" commented Johnny Cullen, the apprentice. "Who this mysterious Scarlet Pimpernel is?" "Perhaps he isn't," said old Clutterbuck, who was clerk of the vestry at the Church of St. John's the Evangelist. "Yes," he added sententiously, for he was fond of his own sayings, and usually liked to repeat them before he had quite done with them. "That's it, you may be sure. Perhaps he isn't." "What do you mean, Master Clutterbuck?" asked Ursula Queckett, for she knew the old man liked to explain his wise saws, and as she wanted to marry his son, she indulged him whenever she could. "What do you mean? He isn't what?" "He isn't, that's all," explained Clutterbuck with vague solemnity. Then, seeing that he had gained the attention of the little party around him, he condescended to come to more logical phraseology. "I mean that, perhaps we must not ask, who is this mysterious Scarlet Pimpernel, but who was that poor and unfortunate gentleman?" "Then you think," suggested Mistress Polly, who felt unaccountably low-spirited at this oratorical pronouncement. "I have it for a fact," said Mr. Clutterbuck solemnly, "that he whom they call the Scarlet Pimpernel no longer exists now, that he was collared by the Frenchies as far back as last fall, and in the language of the poets, has never been heard of no more." Mr. Clutterbuck was very fond of quoting from the works of certain writers whose names he never mentioned, but who went by the poetical generality of the poets. Whenever he made use of phrases which he was supposed to derive from these great and unnamed authors, he solemnly and mechanically raised his hat as a tribute of respect to these giant minds. "You think that the Scarlet Pimpernel is dead, Mr. Clutterbuck? That those horrible Frenchies murdered him? Surely you don't mean that?" sighed Mistress Polly ruefully. Mr. Clutterbuck put his hand up to his hat, preparatory, no doubt, to making another appeal to the mysterious poets, but was interrupted in the very act of uttering great thoughts by a loud and prolonged laugh which came echoing from a distant corner of the grounds. "Lud, but I'd know that laugh anywhere," said Mistress Queckett, whilst all eyes were turned in the direction whence the merry noise had come. Half a head taller than any of his friends around him, his lazy blue eyes scanning from beneath their drooping lids the motley throng around him, stood Sir Percy Blakeney, the centre of a gaily dressed little group which seemingly had just crossed the toll-gate. "A fine specimen of a man, for sure," remarked Johnny Cullen, the apprentice. "Aye, you may take your Bible oath on that," sighed Mistress Polly, who was inclined to be sentimental. "Speakin' as the poets," pronounced Mr. Clutterbuck sententiously, "inches don't make a man." "Nor fine clothes, neither," added Master Jezzard, who did not approve of Mistress Polly's sentimental sigh. "There's my lady," gasped Miss Barbara suddenly, clutching Master Clutterbuck's arm vigorously. "Lud, but she is beautiful today!" Beautiful indeed, and radiant with youth and happiness, Marguerite Blakeney had just gone through the gates and was walking along the sward towards the bandstand. She was dressed in clinging robes of shimmery green texture, the new-fashioned high-waisted effect suiting her graceful figure to perfection. The large charlotte, made of velvet to match the gown, cast a deep shadow over the upper part of her face, and gave a peculiar softness to the outline of her forehead and cheeks. Long lace mittens covered her arms and hands, and a scarf of diaphanous material, edged with dull gold, hung loosely around her shoulders. Yes, she was beautiful. No captious chronicler has ever denied that, and no one who knew her before, and who saw her again on this late summer's afternoon, could fail to mark the additional charm of her magnetic personality. There was a tenderness in her face as she turned her head to and fro, a joy of living in her eyes that was quite irresistibly fascinating. Just now she was talking animatedly with the young girl who was walking beside her, and laughing merrily the while. "Nay, we'll find your Paul, never fear. Lud, child, have you forgotten he is in England now, and that there's no fear of his being kidnapped here on the green in broad daylight?" The young girl gave a slight shudder, and her childlike face became a shade paler than before. Marguerite took her hand and gave it a kindly pressure. Juliet Marny, but lately come to England, saved from under the very knife of the guillotine by a timely and daring rescue, could scarcely believe as yet that she and the man she loved were really out of danger. "There is Monsieur Deroulede," said Marguerite after a slight pause, giving the young girl time to recover herself and pointing to a group of men close by. "He is among friends, as you see." They made such a pretty picture, these two women, as they stood together for a moment on the green with the brilliant September sun throwing golden reflections and luminous shadows on their slender forms. Marguerite, tall and queen-like in her rich gown and costly jewels, wearing with glorious pride the invisible crown of happy wifehood. Juliet, slim and girlish, dressed all in white, with a soft straw hat on her fair curls, and bearing on an otherwise young and childlike face the hard imprint of the terrible suffering she had undergone, of the deathly moral battle her tender soul had had to fight. Soon a group of friends joined them, Paul Deroulede among these, also Sir Andrew and Lady Ffoulkes, and strolling slowly towards them, his hands buried in the pockets of his fine cloth breeches, his broad shoulders set to advantage in a coat of immaculate cut, priceless lace ruffles at neck and wrist, came the inimitable Sir Percy. End of chapter 4. Chapter 5 of The Elusive Pimpernel by Baroness Orsi. Read for LibriVox.org by Karen Savage in December 2007. Chapter 5. Sir Percy and His Lady. To all appearances he had not changed since those early days of matrimony, when his young wife dazzled London society by her wit and by her beauty, and he was one of the many satellites that helped to bring into bold relief the brilliance of her presence, of her sallies, and of her smiles. His friends alone, mayhap, and of these only an intimate few, had understood that beneath that self-same lazy manner, those shy and awkward ways, that half-inane, half-cynical laugh, there now lurked an undercurrent of tender and passionate happiness. That Lady Blakeney was in love with her own husband nobody could fail to see, and in the more frivolous cliques of fashionable London this extraordinary phenomenon had oft been eagerly discussed. "A monstrous thing, of a truth, for a woman of fashion to adore her own husband," was the universal pronouncement of the gaily decked little world that centred around Carlton House in Ranelagh. Not that Sir Percy Blakeney was unpopular with the fair sex. Far be it from the voracious chronicler's mind even to suggest such a thing. The ladies would have voted any gathering dull if Sir Percy's witty sallies did not ring from end to end of the dancing-hall, if his new satin coat and broidered waistcoat did not call for comment or admiration. But that was the frivolous set, to which Lady Blakeney had never belonged. It was well known that she had always viewed her good-natured husband as the most willing and most natural butt for her caustic wit. She still was fond of aiming a shaft or two at him, and he was still equally ready to let the shaft glance harmlessly against the flawless shield of his own imperturbable good humour. But now, contrary to all precedent, to all usages and customs of London society, Marguerite seldom was seen at routs or at the opera without her husband. She accompanied him to all the races, and even one night, oh horror, had danced the gavotte with him. Society shuddered and wondered, tried to put Lady Blakeney's sudden infatuation down to foreign eccentricity, and finally consoled herself with the thought that, after all, this nonsense could not last, and that she was too clever a woman and he too perfect a gentleman to keep up this abnormal state of things for any length of time. In the meanwhile, the ladies averred that this matrimonial love was a very one-sided affair. No one could assert that Sir Percy was anything but politely indifferent to his wife's obvious attentions. His lazy eyes never once lighted up when she entered a ballroom, and there were those who knew for a fact that her ladyship spent many lonely days in her beautiful home at Richmond, whilst her lord and master absented himself with persistence, if unchivalrous, regularity. His presence at the gala had been a surprise to everyone, for all thought him still away, fishing in Scotland or shooting in Yorkshire, anywhere save close to the apron-strings of his doting wife. He himself seemed conscious of the fact that he had not been expected at this end-of-summer fete, for as he strolled forward to meet his wife and Juliette Marny, and acknowledge with a bow here and a nod there the many greetings from subordinates and friends, there was quite an apologetic air about his good-looking face, and an obvious shyness in his smile. But Marguerite gave a happy little laugh as she saw him coming towards her. "Oh, Sir Percy," she said gaily, "and pray, have you seen the show? I vow 'tis the maddest, merriest throng I've seen for many a day. Nay, but for the sighs and shudders of my poor little Juliet, I should be enjoying one of the liveliest days of my life." She patted Juliet's arm affectionately. "Do not shame me before Sir Percy," murmured the young girl, casting shy glances at the elegant cavalier before her, vainly trying to find in the indolent, foppish personality of this society butterfly some trace of the daring man of action, the bold adventurer who had snatched her and her lover from out the very tumbril that bore them both to death. "I know I ought to be gay," she continued, with an attempt at a smile. "I ought to forget everything, save what I owe to—" Sir Percy's laugh broke in on her half-finished sentence. "Lud! And to think of all that I ought not to forget," he said loudly. "Tony here has been clamouring for iced punch this last half-hour, and I promised to find a booth wherein the noble liquid is properly dispensed. Within half an hour from now His Royal Highness will be here. I assure you, Mademoiselle Juliette, that from that time onwards I have to endure the qualms of the damned, for the heir to Great Britain's throne always contrives to be thirsty when I am satiated, which is Tantalus's torture magnified a thousandfold, or to be satiated when my parched palate most requires solace. In either case I am a most pitiable man." "In either case you contrive to talk a deal of nonsense, Sir Percy," said Marguerite gaily. "What else would your ladyship have me do this lazy hot afternoon?" "Come and view the booths with me," she said. "I am dying for a sight of the fat woman and the lean man, the pig-faced child, the dwarfs and the giants. There, Monsieur de Roulette," she added, turning to the young Frenchman who was standing close beside her, "take Mademoiselle Juliette to hear the clavecin players. I vow she is tired of my company." The gaily dressed group was breaking up. Juliette and Paul de Roulette were only too ready to stroll off arm in arm together, and Sir Andrew Ffoulkes was ever in attendance on his young wife. For one moment Marguerite caught her husband's eye. No one was within earshot. "Percy," she said.
"Yes, my dear."
"When did you return?"
"Early this morning."
"You crossed over from Calais?"
"From Boulogne."
"Why did you not let me know sooner?"
"I could not, dear. I arrived at my lodgings in town looking a disgusting object. I could not appear before you until I had washed some of the French mud from off my person. Then His Royal Highness demanded my presence. He wanted news of the Duchesse de Verneuil, whom I had the honour of escorting over from France. By the time I had told him all that he wished to hear, there was no chance of finding you at home, and I thought I should see you here." Marguerite said nothing for a moment, but her foot impatiently tapped the ground, and her fingers were fidgeting with the gold fringe of her scarf. The look of joy, of exquisite happiness, seemed to have suddenly vanished from her face. There was a deep furrow between her brows. She sighed a short, sharp sigh, and cast a rapid upward glance at her husband. He was looking down at her, smiling good-naturedly, a trifle sarcastically, perhaps, and the frown on her face deepened.
"Percy,"
she said abruptly.
"Yes, my dear."
"These anxieties are terrible to bear.
You have been twice over to France within the last month, dealing with your life as lightly as if it did not now belong to me. When will you give up these mad adventures, and leave others to fight their own battles and to save their own lives as best they may?"
She had spoken with increased vehemence, although her voice was scarce raised above a whisper. Even in her sudden, passionate anger, she was on her guard not to betray his secret. He did not reply immediately, but seemed to be studying the beautiful face on which heartbroken anxiety was now distinctly imprinted. Then he turned and looked at the solitary booth in the distance, across the frontal of which a large placard had recently been affixed, bearing the words, "Come and see the true representation of the guillotine." In front of the booth, a man dressed in ragged breeches, with Phrygian cap on his head, adorned with a tricolour cockade, was vigorously beating a drum, shouting volubly the while, "Come in and see, come in and see, the only realistic presentation of the original guillotine! Hundreds perish in Paris every day, come and see, come and see, the perfectly vivid performance of what goes on hourly in Paris at the present moment!" Marguerite had followed the direction of Sir Percy's eyes. She too was looking at the booth. She heard the man's monotonous, raucous cries. She gave a slight shudder, and once more looked imploringly at her husband. His face, though outwardly as lazy and calm as before, had a strange set look about the mouth and firm jaw, and his slender hand, the hand of a dandy accustomed to handle cards and dice and to play lightly with the foils, was clutched tightly beneath the folds of the priceless Mechlin frills. It was but a momentary stiffening of the whole powerful frame, an instant's flash of the ruling passion hidden within that very secretive soul. Then he once more turned towards her, the rigid lines of his face relaxed, he broke into a pleasant laugh, and with the most elaborate and most courtly bow, he took her hand in his, and raising her fingers to his lips, he gave the answer to her questions. "When your ladyship has ceased to be the most admired woman in Europe, namely, when I am in my grave." End of chapter 5. Chapter 6 of The Elusive Pimpernel by Baroness Orzy, read for LibriVox.org by Karen Savage in December 2007. Chapter 6. For the Poor of Paris. There was no time to say more then, for the laughing, chatting groups of friends had once more closed up round Marguerite and her husband, and she, ever on the alert, gave neither look nor sign that any serious conversation had taken place between Sir Percy and herself. Whatever she might feel or dread with regard to the foolhardy adventures in which he still persistently embarked, no member of the League ever guarded the secret of his chief more loyally than did Marguerite Blakeney. Though her heart overflowed with a passionate pride in her husband, she was clever enough to conceal every emotion save that which nature had insisted on imprinting in her face, her present radiant happiness and her irresistible love. And thus before the world she kept up that bantering way with him which had characterized her earlier matrimonial life, that good-natured, easy contempt which he had so readily accepted in those days, and which their entourage would have missed and would have inquired after if she had changed her manner towards him too suddenly. In her heart she knew full well that within Percy Blakeney's soul she had a great and powerful rival, his wild, mad, passionate love of adventure. For it he would sacrifice everything, even his life. She dared not ask herself if he would sacrifice his love. Twice in a few weeks he had been over to France. Every time he went she could not know if she would ever see him again. She could not imagine how the French Committee of Public Safety could so clumsily allow the hated Scarlet Pimpernel to slip through its fingers. But she never attempted either to warn him or to beg him not to go. When he brought Paul de Roulède and Juliette Marny over from France, her heart went out to the two young people in sheer gladness and pride, because of his precious life, which he had risked for them. She loved Juliette for the dangers Percy had passed, for the anxieties she herself had endured. Only today, in the midst of this beautiful sunshine, this joy of the earth, of summer and of the sky, she had suddenly felt a mad, overpowering anxiety, a deadly hatred of the wild, adventurous life which took him so often away from her side. His pleasant, bantering reply precluded her following up the subject, whilst the merry chatter of people round her warned her to keep her words and looks under control. But she seemed now to feel the want of being alone, and somehow that distant booth, with its flaring placard, and the crier in the Phrygian cap, exercised a weird fascination over her. Instinctively she bent her steps thither, and equally instinctively the idle throng of her friends followed her. Sir Percy alone had halted in order to converse with Lord Hastings, who had just arrived. "Surely, Lady Blakeney, you have no thought of patronizing that gruesome spectacle," said Lord Antony Dewhurst, as Marguerite almost mechanically had paused within a few yards of the solitary booth. "I don't know," she said with enforced gaiety. "The place seems to attract me. And I need not look at the spectacle," she added significantly, as she pointed to a roughly scribbled notice at the entrance of the tent, "in aid of the starving poor of Paris. There's a good-looking woman who sings, and a hideous mechanical toy that moves," said one of the young men in the crowd. "It is very dark and close inside the tent. I was lured in there for my sins, and was in a mighty hurry to come out again." "Then it must be my sins that are helping to lure me too at the present moment," said Marguerite lightly. "I pray you all to let me go in there. I want to hear the good-looking woman sing, even if I do not see the hideous toy on the move." "May I escort you then, Lady Blakeney?" said Lord Tony. "Nay, I would rather go in alone," she replied, a trifle impatiently. "I beg of you not to heed my whim, and to await my return there, where the music is at its merriest." It had been bad manners to insist. Marguerite, with a little comprehensive nod to all her friends, left the young cavaliers still protesting, and quickly passed beneath the roughly constructed doorway that gave access into the booth. A man, dressed in theatrical rags and wearing the characteristic scarlet cap, stood immediately within the entrance, and ostentatiously rattled a money-box at regular intervals. "For the starving poor of Paris," he drawled out in nasal, monotonous tones the moment he caught sight of Marguerite and of her rich gown. She dropped some gold into the box, and then passed on. The interior of the booth was dark and lonely-looking after the glare of the hot September sun, and the noisy crowd that thronged the sward outside. Evidently a performance had just taken place on the elevated platform beyond, for a few yokels seemed to be lingering in a desultory manner, as if preparatory to going out. A few disjointed comments reached Marguerite's ears as she approached, and the small groups parted to allow her to pass. One or two women gaped in astonishment at her beautiful dress, whilst others bobbed a respectful curtsy. The mechanical toy arrested her attention immediately. She did not find it as gruesome as she expected, only singularly grotesque, with all those little wooden figures in their quaint, arrested action. She drew nearer to have a better look, and the yokels who had lingered behind paused, wondering if she would make any remark. "Her ladyship was born in France," murmured one of the men close to her. "She would know if the thing really looks like that." "She do seem interested," quoth another in a whisper. "Lud love us all," said a buxom wench who was clinging to the arm of a nervous-looking youth. "I believe they're coming for more money." On the elevated platform at the further end of the tent, a slim figure had just made its appearance, that of a young woman dressed in peculiarly sombre colours, and with a black lace hood thrown lightly over her head. Marguerite thought that the face seemed familiar to her, and she also noticed that the woman carried a large embroidered reticule in her bemittened hand. There was a general exodus the moment she appeared. The Richmond yokels did not like the look of that reticule. They felt that sufficient demand had already been made upon their scant purses, considering the meagreness of the entertainment, and they dreaded being lured to further extravagance. When Marguerite turned away from the mechanical toy, the last of the little crowd had disappeared, and she was alone in the booth with the woman in the dark kirtle and black lace hood. "For the Boar of Paris, madame," said the latter mechanically, holding out her reticule. Marguerite was looking at her intently. The face certainly seemed familiar, recalling to her mind the far-off days in Paris before she married. Some young actress, no doubt, driven out of France by that terrible turmoil which had caused so much sorrow and so much suffering. The face was pretty, the figure slim and elegant, and the look of obvious sadness in the dark, almond-shaped eyes was calculated to inspire sympathy and pity. Yet, strangely enough, Lady Blakeney felt repelled and chilled by this somberly dressed young person. An instinct which she could not have explained, and which she felt had no justification, warned her that, somehow or other, the sadness was not quite genuine, the appeal for the poor not quite heartfelt. Nevertheless, she took out her purse, and dropping some few sovereigns into the capacious reticule, she said very kindly, "I hope that you are satisfied with your day's work, madame. I fear me our British country folk hold the strings of their purses somewhat tightly these times." The woman sighed and shrugged her shoulders. "Oh, madame," she said, with a tone of great dejection, "one does what one can for one's starving countrymen, but it is very hard to elicit sympathy over here for them, poor dears." "You are a Frenchwoman, of course," rejoined Marguerite, who had noted that though the woman spoke English with a very pronounced foreign accent, she had nevertheless expressed herself with wonderful fluency and correctness. "Just like Lady Blakeney herself," replied the other. "You know who I am? Who could come to Richmond and not know Lady Blakeney by sight?" "But what made you come to Richmond on this philanthropic errand of yours?" "I go where I think there is a chance of earning a little money for the cause which I have at heart," replied the Frenchwoman, with the same gentle simplicity, the same tone of mournful dejection. What she said was undoubtedly noble and selfless. Lady Blakeney felt in her heart that her keenest sympathy should have gone out to this young woman, pretty, dainty, hardly more than a girl, who seemed to be devoting her young life in a purely philanthropic and unselfish cause. And yet, in spite of herself, Marguerite seemed unable to shake off that curious sense of mistrust which had assailed her from the first, nor that feeling of unreality and staginess with which the Frenchwoman's attitude had originally struck her. Yet she tried to be kind, to be cordial, tried to hide that coldness in her manner which she felt was unjustified. "It is all very praiseworthy on your part, madame," she said somewhat lamely. "Madame," she added interrogatively. "My name is Candeille, Désirée Candeille," replied the Frenchwoman. "Candeille!" exclaimed Marguerite with sudden alacrity. "Candeille, surely—" "Yes, of the Variété." "Ah, then I know why your face from the first seemed familiar to me," said Marguerite, this time with unaffected cordiality. "I must have applauded you many a time in the olden days. I am an ex-colleague, you know. My name was Saint-Just before I married, and I was of the Maison Molière." "I knew that," said Désirée Candeille, and half hoped that you would remember me. Nay, who could forget Demoiselle Candé, the most popular star in the theatrical firmament? Oh, that was so long ago. Only 4 years. A fallen star is soon lost out of sight. Why fallen? It was a choice for me between exile from France and the guillotine, rejoined Candé simply. Surely not, queried Marguerite with a touch of genuine sympathy. With characteristic impulsiveness, she had now cast aside her former misgivings. She had conquered her mistrust, at any rate had relegated it to the background of her mind. This woman was a colleague. She had suffered and was in distress. She had every claim, therefore, on a compatriot's help and friendship. She stretched out her hand and took Desiree Candé's in her own. She forced herself to feel nothing but admiration for this young woman, whose whole attitude spoke of sorrows nobly borne, of misfortunes proudly endured.
"I don't know why I should sadden you with my story," rejoined Desiree Candé after a slight pause, during which she seemed to be waging war against her own emotion. "It is not a very interesting one. Hundreds have suffered as I did. I had enemies in Paris. God knows how that happened. I had never harmed anyone. But someone must have hated me, and must have wished me ill. Evil is so easily wrought in France these days. A denunciation, a perquisition, an accusation, then the flight from Paris, the forged passports, the disguise, the bribe, the hardships, the squalid hiding-places. Oh, I have gone through it all. Tasted every kind of humiliation, endured every kind of insult. Remember that I was not a noble aristocrat, a duchess or an impoverished countess," she added with marked bitterness, "or perhaps the English cavaliers whom the popular voice has called the League of the Scarlet Pimpernel would have taken some interest in me. I was only a poor actress, and had to find my way out of France alone, or else perish on the guillotine." "I am so sorry," said Marguerite simply. "Tell me how you got on, once you were in England," she continued after a while, seeing that Desiree Candé seemed absorbed in thought. "I had a few engagements at first," replied the Frenchwoman. "I played at Sadler's Wells, and with Mrs. Jordan at Covent Garden. But the Aliens Bill put an end to my chances of livelihood. No manager cared to give me a part, and so—" "And so?" "Oh, I had a few jewels, and I sold them. A little money, and I live on that. But when I played at Covent Garden I contrived to send part of my salary over to some of the poorer clubs of Paris. My heart aches for those that are starving. Poor wretches. They are misguided and misled by self-seeking demagogues. It hurts me to feel that I can do nothing more to help them, and eases my self-respect if by singing at public fairs I can still send a few francs to those who are poorer than myself." She had spoken with ever-increasing passion and vehemence. Marguerite, with eyes fixed into vacancy, seeing neither the speaker nor her surroundings, seeing only visions of those same poor wreckages of humanity who had been goaded into thirst for blood when their shrunken bodies should have been clamouring for healthy food, Marguerite, thus absorbed, had totally forgotten her earlier prejudices, and now completely failed to note all that was unreal, stagey, theatrical, in the oratorical declamations of the ex-actress from the Variété. Preeminently true and loyal herself, in spite of the many deceptions and treacheries which she had witnessed in her life, she never looked for falsehood or for cant in others. Even now she only saw before her a woman who had been wrongfully persecuted, who had suffered and had forgiven those who had caused her to suffer. She bitterly accused herself for her original mistrust of this noble-hearted, unselfish woman, who was content to tramp around in an alien country, bartering her talents for a few coins, in order that some of those who were the originators of her sorrows might have bread to eat and a bed in which to sleep. "Mademoiselle," she said warmly, "truly you shame me, who am also French-born, with the many sacrifices you so nobly make for those who should have first claim on my own sympathy. Believe me, if I have not done as much as duty demanded of me in the cause of my starving compatriots, it has not been for lack of goodwill. Is there any way now," she added eagerly, "in which I can help you? Putting aside the question of money, wherein I pray you to command my assistance, what can I do to be of useful service to you?"
"You are very kind, Lady Blakeney," said the other hesitatingly. "Well, what is it? I see there is something in your mind."
"It is, perhaps, difficult to express. But people say I have a good voice. I sing some French ditties. They are a novelty in England, I think. If I could sing them in fashionable salons, I might perhaps—" "Nay, you shall sing in fashionable salons.
exclaimed Marguerite eagerly. "You shall become the fashion, and I'll swear the Prince of Wales himself shall bid you sing at Carlton House, and you shall name your own fee, mademoiselle, and London society shall vie with the elite of Bath, as to which shall lure you to its most frequented routs. There, there! You shall make a fortune for the Paris poor, and to prove to you that I mean every word I say, you shall begin your triumphant career in my own salon tomorrow night. His Royal Highness will be present. You shall sing your most engaging songs, and for your fee you must accept 100 guineas, which you shall send to the poorest workmen's club in Paris in the name of Sir Percy and Lady Blakeney."
"I thank your ladyship, but you'll not refuse?"
"I'll accept gladly, but you will understand, I am not very old," said Candeille quaintly. I am only an actress, but if a young actress is unprotected, then..."
"I understand," replied Marguerite gently, "that you are far too pretty to frequent the world all alone, and that you have a mother, or a sister, or a friend, which, whom you would wish to escort you tomorrow, is that it?"
"Nay," rejoined the actress with marked bitterness, "I have neither mother nor sister, but our revolutionary government, with tardy compassion for those it has so relentlessly driven out of France, has deputed a representative of theirs in England to look after the interests of French subjects over here."
"Yes?"
"They have realized over in Paris that my life here has been devoted to the welfare of the poor people in France. The representative whom the government has sent to England is specially interested in me and in my work. He is a standby for me in case of trouble, in case of insults. A woman alone is oft subject to those, even at the hands of so-called gentlemen. And the official representative of my own country becomes in such cases my most natural protector."
"I understand."
"You will receive him?"
"Certainly."
"Then may I present him to your ladyship?"
"Whenever you like."
"Now, if it please you."
"Now?"
"Yes. Here he comes, at your ladyship's service."
Desiree Candeille's almond-shaped eyes were fixed upon a distant part of the tent, behind Lady Blakeney, in the direction of the main entrance to the booth. There was a slight pause after she had spoken, and then Marguerite slowly turned in order to see who this official representative of France was, whom, at the young actress's request, she had just agreed to receive in her house. In the doorway of the tent, framed by its gaudy draperies, and with the streaming sunshine as a brilliant background behind him, stood the sable-clad figure of Chauvelin. End of chapter 6.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouth-watering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouth-watering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.